you have to hold these two opposing things at once, and you can get kind of good at it. You can get better at it, and it only makes you happier, really, and more relaxed and okay that there are these grave contradictions, you know, that we all are hypocrites, and that's just how it is, you know. Humor, I think, can do that. My whole life is driven by connection and connecting with people and not feeling alone and building relationships and making people feel good.
Welcome to the Ruth Stonehouse podcast. I'm Bianca Stone, and I'm talking today with the poet Summer Browning, who's the author of the three poetry books, Either Way I'm Celebrating, Backup Singers, and most recently, Good Actors, with the Press Birds LLC. She also tells jokes, draws comics, makes videos, creates installations, hosts readings, curates exhibitions, and works as a librarian in Denver, Colorado. Summer, welcome.
Thank you so much, Bianca.
You said in a recent interview that I read on Southwest Contemporary that, quote, reality has always been a bit suspect to me, slippery. We think we have a handle on things, but how can we when everything is translated through this imperfect body, this fallible memory, these careening feelings? Talk about denial. I know is probably the most comical thing one could say. I love that so much.
I said that? Oh, wow. That. That's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool, right? But what do you think it is about humor that helps us even maybe get at these truths or... you know, it does make me think this diversion. I like that idea of diverting somebody, you know, it almost like puts them at ease in order to be able to disclose the punchline, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. It is. There is some kind of like friendship that has to happen between, you know, a funny person and the people they're talking to. There's a trust there that has to be built. So that perhaps, like you're saying, that people can relax a little bit and be diverted away from the nasty, horrible ugliness and pain and suffering. And then when the storyteller or the comedian, the poet wants to say it, they're ready for it somehow. They're accustomed to the voice. They trust the tone and the voice and the motion, and the feeling, you know, and that's why I think too, you know, there's this vulnerability, you give up some vulnerability or you show some vulnerability. And that makes your audience vulnerable and more comfortable. Something like those things start happening. You know, it's also just, for me, it's a little more than just what is in my art and a tool in that regard, because I sort of live my life that way too, right? To always be putting on these glasses of like subverting things or undermining things, or like what is really being said here, or what's the funny part of this horrible tragedy. And I don't know, coping mechanism or something, improper attachment at some certain age. I don't know. It's an intellectual game in a certain way, too. And, you know, like if I don't go to therapy right now, I keep thinking I should go back. But ever since I got back from Mexico, I was like, I don't need that. I had 4 months in Mexico. I feel great. But I would always right when we get to some kind of painful point, make a joke, you know? And right, and of course, right. She defense always mechanism. Wanted to talk about that. And it's interesting, but it never felt like I was like, it always felt like I was like further exploring the thing. I don't know, in order to relay some of these very complicated positions and feelings we get into, it seems like humor can get at it like exquisitely in a different way than it's like saying I'm sad.
You know, I'm also remembering something about Freud saying that jokes told so much about the unconscious and revealed as much as a dream could. And I think that's really true. I think we can tell a lot about the way people joke. And I also have noticed that comedians, it always seems like they actually do have like a very almost traumatized side of them that you catch glimpses of. And of course, I feel like there's a weird parallel between poets and comedians. Like poets get up there on stage and say, and are very vulnerable, and like it's very linked to timing, and poets always try and be funny in between poems.
They try really hard. Yeah, there's also the look at me, look at me, look at me that we have in common. You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah, look at me, like Hong Kong.
Everybody wants to be funny. That's another thing. I mean, it's just probably linked to, you know, our serotonin levels or cortisol levels too. I mean, you want to laugh. You want to be around funny people. I mean, you smile and you feel a little bit better. It's powerful, like intellectually. It's powerful biologically. It's powerful in society. You know, we revere mm-hmm. funny people. We have fights about who's funny. We have fights about what you can say and if it's a joke or if it's not.
Well, I'd love to hear a poem from the book.
It's a weird book. I mean, there's a lot of different things going on in here.
No, maybe we should read. Let's read the good actor's poem. Title poem.
Good actors. I want to make a movie before I turn 45 about two characters exchanging money. I give them directions. I say to them, earnestly, as if holding grilled cheeses, they push the money into each other's hands. I call out, reluctantly. They look down and say, God damn it, this is the last time, Ray, and weave it between their fingers. They are good actors. So I say, hopefully. They blink and gaze into their hands like into a new baby. Angrily, I say, they gnaw the money to confetti. I tell them, as if in mourning, and the money fevers down their wrists, and now, like a bank, they fist and throw it like garbage. And a forest, now a forest, like seed they sow it. You're doing very well, I say. They drop it at my feet. Exuberantly, I say, they remove their clothing. Lovingly, I say, they move toward me. They are such good actors. They turn off the camera. What's that one about, Bianca?
I was thinking something about like the persona of self in poetry and in this book, and you know, it links back to the idea of autobiography and poetry. And, you know, who are these people, who are these speakers that we place in our poems, and the people that populate our poems too, the ghosts from our past or from the present, you know, our children or our family. And we are sort of like directors, right? We're directors of the poem, but it's also a meta conversation because we're kind of directors of our own life. And when you were talking about distilling poetry down to, you know, editing out certain things in memory and placing certain things in poems. You know, there's such this like curatorial aspect that's so intense in poetry, but it's also, I mean, it mimics life too, right? Like just how we choose to, you know, some we choose, some we don't choose, right? Some is unconscious, but like, I think it's significant that it's two people and a kind of couple, and it's about money. And, you know, there's a lot about divorce, not a lot, but it's certainly there in the book, and relationships and sexuality and hooking up. And that this sort of like faceless speaker director is in the poem directing these two people. And then by the end of the poem, they're like, okay, turn off the camera. And then it feels like, okay, we're all about to like hook up or something, you know? Right. So at one point the camera gets turned off and the relational really comes together. Right. So it's somewhat of not performative anymore. We're not directing one another. We're actually just really coming together.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I don't know. That's awesome. Yeah.
That's my analysis.
I mean, right. I think that's the connection here. You know, my whole life is driven by connection and connecting with people and not feeling alone and building relationships and making right. people feel good and making myself feel good and understanding people. God, it's just like that is what drives me every single aspect of my life. Yeah, and so I see that in here. Yeah, that perhaps the director's real intention is to connect, and they're such good actors, they know that, and they breach
right,
that
exactly,
and bring that person in, and that's pretty sad. It's sad. It's touching. It's moving, and it's generous and very human. Yeah,
absolutely. The way the book is constructed is so magnificent, and it's not overly constructed too. It feels like very natural. It feels very in honor of how you interact with art in general. But one thing that holds the book together is sort of this weaving in of these untitled snippets of poems that originated, I read in the back on Twitter, asking a question about Twilight Zone. And if you tell which Twilight Zone episode you remember best, I can tell you what your problem is. And what I loved about these is that they serve a kind of mocking pop psychology, cultural reference, you know, like which Disney villain or even are you, or those annoying personality test quizzes online that you see constantly thrown at you. It's sort of mocking those, but they're also rife with completely genuine psychological insight. 100%, you know, and I noticed that each one was such a riff on our human capacity to contrast everything and not be able to, and how much suffering that can cause if we're not able to, sort of accept these two opposing forces that we're forcing ourselves into. For example, you believe in the truth of action over the truth of feeling, which neither is accurate, and this causes great pain.
Yeah, they see that a lot in this world right now. Maybe it's always been there, this Western world of this binary and this demand to choose among usually really crappy choices.
Right.
You know, when you engage in that, which we have to survive, to work, to raise our children, to create our art, it's really difficult. And it's not life affirming, you know? I mean, there's great power in saying, you know, I'm just not going to choose. I mean, I sound like Bartleby a little bit, but you do have that power. And I think there's a lot of structures in societies, and there's the scramble for money and notoriety and fame that are all trying to force you to choose. And you know, what we have and what we hold the most, what is intrinsic sort of in our being, is that right to participate, to not participate, to take it on, to get angry at the internet, to not get angry at the internet, you know? So even I like that. Yeah, I am sort of poking fun at at pop psychology, which is just preying again, sort of on our human condition of like, who am I? Tell me what I am. Tell me what to do. I'm, you know, yeah. I'm a mess. I don't know what's going on. You know, it's like, yeah, you don't. You were born into this bananas world, just popped out of your mom, and they're like, here you go. Here's a world on fire. Navigate it. But only within these confines, you know. Don't navigate it too much. Follow our rules. Don't make up your own rules.
Right.
But I mean, and so these answers that you just read, they do ring true, but it's, again, it's still sort of like trapped in that dichotomy. Like, why the answer should be more like fly a kite, you know? Why, you know, let's veer away from that and talk about like how to engage and reinsert yourself into life affirming behaviors. I feel like I'm rambling, but yes,
it's like
yeah,
intellectualizing.
We love intellectualizing. This culture does, yeah.
Right, instead of just being.
Yeah, and I love it though. I mean, I have a good mind for it too. I think that's why I love it so much too, because I'm kind of good at it. I love everything that I'm good at. And that doesn't feel like it has much integrity. I feel a little embarrassed about that, but it's true. So
I feel like one of your little things would be a good response to that. I was wondering, could you read some of them? Just maybe three or four, or maybe some from the long one.
Okay. If you tell me which Twilight Zone episode you remember best, I can tell you what your problem is. The one where Charles Bronson eats fried chicken out of a can in a post-apocalyptic world. Your problem is you believe that you can never fully know another, and this prevents you from offering unconditional love. If you tell me what Twilight Zone episode you remember best, I can tell you what your problem is. The one with the old people who play kick the can and become young. Your problem is you can remain in the space between action and inaction so long that it causes stasis. If you tell me which Twilight Zone episode you remember best, I can tell you what your problem is. A game of pool. Your problem is you give too much credence to the beliefs others have about your abilities. You know what's super fun is reading from this and then just going into this litany of telling the audience what their problem is. So like on page 79 or 80, yeah, when there's like this accumulation of those, that refrain, and you're up there, yeah, it's very hilarious and gross and funny and wonderful. But just like, your problem is this, your problem is this, like to the audience.
You mean are you actually asking audience members about?
No, I haven't done that yet, but I've been thinking about that. I have some readings coming up, so I you know, don't like the traditional I speak, you listen and sit there and ooh and ah poetry reading. So I often try to have some kind of call and response or back and forth. So yeah, I've been sort of wondering how I can perform those a little more with that in mind. But you know, there's also like this thing, this like artist as like authority, or artist as person who knows more than you do, you know, like they see something you can't see. And then you sort of, you know, you put them on a pedestal in a sort of way. So I was sort of trying to get at that too. Like the artist turned guru or the poet turned guru. And it's
thinking about how psychology, you know, or psychoanalysis works in that relational way is so akin to the true way that poetry works, is that it's not the poet as this sagacious, like, wisdom imparter, as much as it is about the participation that the reader is having with the poet and the poem while they're reading it. And that the poem couldn't mean anything or exist at all or have any sort of power without the reader coming in with their reality and imparting it upon the poem. And the poem is sort of like, it's sort of interesting because it's like the poem we created out of our own biographical experience with the world. It's almost like it exits that and is like in this like liminal, like orb state in between, you know, and then the reader comes over and they like gingerly take it in their hands and they're like, and then they, you know, they infuse their autobiography into and their knowledge of the world and their strange perceptions of the way things are and their unconscious into it as well. And you've given them that opportunity, yeah. Simply, almost. Oh, like,
I love that. I love that. I love the way you made me see that. Yeah. And we love doing that. We've done it since the dawn of time. That's very cool.
Yeah.
I'm trying to look for through lines in humanity, you know, that I can sort of cling to as the empire crumbles. And that's definitely one of them I've thought about. And to me, perhaps, you know, I'm not totally sure, but you know, the impetus there is connection, and to be like, can you believe it? Can you believe we're here? There's trees outside blowing around. Can you believe that, you know, I'm a human on this planet? And the other person says, no, I can't. Can you believe that I'm a human on this planet? And you just bond over this wild, wild experience. Yeah. Yet.
I really want to read a couple other poems in here.
Well, then I'm going to do the Grey Gardens one. Into an empty swimming pool, diving in love. I think Grey Gardens is a perfect movie. It also happens to be good. Grey Gardens is a documentary about a mother and a daughter, both defunct relatives of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, and their poverty-stricken lives in a run-down mansion called Grey Gardens. They are both named Edith, but the mother is called Big Edie and the daughter Little Edie. There's no movie more about women than this movie. This movie is about what happens when women are permitted to become feral. What happens when women are permitted to revel in their own psychology and plumb it, free from some parts of the panopticon. I see in these women my entire life, not the details, of course, but a thick layer of it, the worries and obsessions and deep connections and fluctuating esteem. When Little Edie talks about feeling trapped at Grey Gardens, Big Edie says to her, "You can't get any freedom when you're being supported." Little Edie says, "I think you're not free when you're not being supported." Then a bit later, Little Edie adds, "It's awful both ways." I write in a poem about an old friend named Melissa naming her daughter Melissa. How patriarchal, I say in the poem, acknowledging that because Melissa and Melissa are women, this act is in reality radically anti-patriarchal. Friday night, Sarah and Mary Jane talked with me about the names in their families. Sarah is named after her grandmother. Sarah says her aunts would call each other Mary or Mare, though none of them were named Mary. Mary stood for girl. Hey, Mare. Hey, girlfriend. Hey, girl. My mother called my sister and me her little girlfriends. Mama's little girlfriend, she would sing song when we were feverish while she traced her fingers on our foreheads. I call my daughter Friend. Friend, can you help me in the kitchen? Did you have any dreams last night, Friend? Roy told us by the fire Friday night that his mother's name was Leela and that his middle name is Lee. He said he hates that middle name, but not because of his mother, because of a man named Lee. When he told us his parents were slaves, everyone went quiet. I wish I could have told Roy that Lee was Jackie Kennedy's middle name, too. But I learned that today, and today is a few days after Friday. Little Edie says, it's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present. Sometimes I cannot point out one boundary between Big Edie and her daughter, Little Edie. That night by the fire with Roy, I remarked that Leela is such a lovely and rare name, but there are other Leelas. Leela Alcorn is a young woman who walked into traffic because she was alone and alienated and condemned for being transgender. She had no support. She had no freedom. I think you're not free when you're not being supported, Little Edie said. And that's the boundary between Big Edie and Little Edie, between mother and daughter, between past and present. You're free when you're supported. You're free when you're supported. We measure love until everyone has it. Yeah, I don't know about that one. I don't know how firmly I stand by that one, honestly. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like I would edit it.
Well, I like that about poems too. I feel obviously the same way about some of my own, and I think it's totally okay. And that's more than okay, just inevitable. I like that you talk in another poem about Lynn Hagenian, I think, my life, and how she edits, speaking of autobiography of another poet writing a poem called Autobiography that is every year of his life so far, but every year he has to edit it to add another year.
Yeah, I mean.
Anyway, the idea that if something's published, it's finished, or not, maybe not.
Yeah, that's kind of, I mean, you know, common, of course, you know, you don't think what you used to think, but there's this great assumption that you're the same person that you always were. And I think it causes a lot of trouble. But there's also this tyranny of the printed texts and of like what gets published. Mm-hmm. And that causes a lot of trouble too.
I want to read another one. Is there one you want to read?
I sort of like to read Life a Draft prologue. I love how, I don't know if this, I just love how many names are in this book. This one doesn't have any names, though. So I'm a liar. Life a Draft prologue. I want those trace amounts of narcotics in the water supply to take effect. I want to write a memoir in one-liners. I want to start a marketing company that unmarkets everything. I want to start a party bus company, but instead of buying a party bus, I'll use the city bus. And instead of partying, we'll just be commuting. I want to write a book so disgusting it makes over-the-shoulder subway readers puke on the people reading it. I want this to be a very, very serious joke book. I want to start saying numb nuts a lot more. To me, life is an infinite jerk-off motion without beginning or end. To me, quantum entanglement is untrue, though it proves the existence of love. To me, more wives wish their husbands dead and more husbands actually do it. To me, I'm surprised I'm still alive. An aphorist who hates aphorisms, a self-helper who hates the self. Every tornado begins as a cartoon dogfight. The joke is you're born. That's why they call it a delivery. Numbnuts.
Oh, I just love it. I just love it so much. Oh, so good. One-liners. I mean, you'd be surprised. You probably wouldn't be surprised, but how people don't write. I feel like their whole book doesn't have a single one-liner in it.
No, how serious you know? Can it's you like, take yourself? Jeez.
Even if it's not. But even if it's not funny, you know, there's something about a one-liner that's like, it's so contained. It's got so much authority in itself, you know, it's so declarative. And it, even if it doesn't, even if it's not funny or doesn't make sense, like it has to sort of stand behind itself, or have something really right. It's like a good contained line in poetry where you're like, you had a great example of like, coffee too in what cup chipped, when you're talking about Alice Notley's poem, and you just sort of like stop and like, it's such a weird line, but there's something like so perfectly aligned in it, you know?
Yeah, I love that shit. Yeah, that's funny that one-liners, they have to stand out there, and they're declarative, and they're like, look at me, and they're like, and they're just saying in this like little tiny baby voice, like, isn't this funny? Like, don't you approve of this? Like, love me. And then, but also they're saying, you know, also it's just like, yeah, that one wasn't funny, so move on to the next one or something. Like, they're like, also like, don't take this seriously. It's a one liner.
Yeah.
Like it really is a way to have both at once.
Right.
Humor, I think, can do that.
That's so true.
And yeah, we were talking earlier about that, maybe inhabiting two things at once, two opposing things at once. And the more roles I take on in life, especially motherhood and other roles, maybe even at work, being a boss or something, you have to hold these two opposing things at once, and you can get kind of good at it. You can get better at it, and it only makes you happier, really, and more relaxed and okay that there are these grave contradictions, you know, that we all are hypocrites, and that's just how it is, you know. Of course, there's extremes, and but I don't know. There's just a lot of lessons to be learned there. Like, I remember when I brought Georgia home from the hospital, she was in her little car seat, and the door was open and the screen was closed. And I had this vision, you know, sleep deprived, in pain, having a tiny, you know, 12-hour child at home. I guess she might have been 48 hours old. I thought this dog might just run into the house and grab her and like tear her to shreds. I just had this wild, grotesque vision.
Right.
And then I imagine, of course, me tearing that dog to shreds at the same time as having this deep well of like love that I've never had before. And I was like, what is going on with me? Am I losing my mind? And
Your daughter, Georgia, does come up in the book quite a few times, and even some lines that she says. And I know that she does cute little memes and stuff. What is it like sharing your poetry and your art world with your daughter?
It's amazing. It's scary. It's, I think, unfolding yet. I don't think I can answer that because, you know, she just knows me as this. She doesn't know too many adults, right? So one of the most important ones does this thing and uses her in her poems and names a gallery after her. And the ramifications of that are unknown yet. You know, she needs some perspective on that to see, God, that was weird. God, that was cool. God, that whatever she's going to determine, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I've made grave mistakes, embarrassing her at readings. She comes to like a lot of readings, and she was just at a reading in Santa Fe I did. And her stepmother, Mary, was there, and Mary took this sweet picture of Georgia had her calico critters like lined up on her leg, like looking out towards me, watching the show as she was watching the show. Aww. And just very sweet and honest and pure or something. But who knows if she's like totally cringing inside. I'm not sure yet.
I'm sure she's doing both, you know. Mom embarrassed me, and then, well, but I also hope so. So proud.
I hope that last part.
Summer, it's just been so wonderful talking with you. I am absolutely just in love with this book, Good Actors, and everyone should buy it. And I'll put a link to where to buy it on our website. And I love everything you're doing. You're such an advocate for poetry and for art, and just for really authentic living.
Thank you, Bianca.
Thank you.
Too. I am always in awe of how far this house has come from kind of being in a shambles. It still is.
Yeah, it's still in a shambles.
I mean,
no,
the
it's
dedication and work that you've put in, and you and your comrades, and it's just, it's so wonderful. I can't wait to visit.